ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Christopher and Pixie Skase flaunted their wealth.
27 white limousines and the champagne flowed.
It couldn't be bigger than Pixie's blonde hair.
Spending other people's money, and when they were found out, Pixie paid the price.
A sort of gilded cage that she was a prisoner in.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. What's your relationship with bread? Lifelong love affair or something where you feel better when you avoid it? Gluten-free diets have become popular even among people who don't have celiac disease, but according to one new study, gluten may not be the culprit we think it is. Also ahead, is your most picture-perfect holiday your best holiday? Science says we tend to conflate the two. How we often romanticise holidays through photos is coming up, plus Formula One engineer and croissant queen Kate Reid on the book that changed her life. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, if you have a teenager in your life, there's one thing that is likely at the top of their Christmas wish list, and that's an e-bike. Power-assisted pedal bikes have lots of benefits. They're great for commuting if you don't want to get too sweaty. They're good for touring around on a holiday. But not all e-bikes are created equal. In fact, many of the models flooding the market at the moment aren't really bikes at all. Some are so heavily modified they're basically motorbikes, and they can be deadly. Over the past week, two children have died in e-bike-related incidents in Queensland. The details of those cases are yet to emerge, but they're tragic ones that sadly aren't isolated to one state. So one of the hardest things for parents to navigate is what kind of e-bike, if any, might be safe for their kid and what are the risks to their safety and others around them. Well, Carl Stade is the Assistant Manager of Life Cycle Bikes in Margaret River in Western Australia. Carl, welcome to Life Matters.
Yeah, good morning.
I guess it's a bit of a moot point because in WA it's illegal for kids under 16 to ride an e-bike.
Yeah, that's true. That is the case. It's a fact that actually not many people in the community seem to be aware of because we're constantly having that conversation with parents about. And that law does vary from state and territory around Australia. So people should always check what the local restrictions are.
So you say that there's not a lot of awareness of it. What are you seeing around on the paths around the bike shop?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of younger crew that are still riding e-bikes, so either the parents are not aware or they simply don't care. And, there's a lot of younger crew riding around. Like, I think by and large, for the most part, most of the younger kids are doing the right thing and they're not making a hazard of themselves, but there's always that minority that are doing the wrong thing and getting themselves into trouble or worse. So unfortunately, there is that minority that's out there. And that's something that we're just trying to work together with local community. We're a local independent store and we're just trying to work together with local community to get everyone on the same page working together.
What kind of conversations are you having with parents when they're coming in to the shop looking to buy an e-bike for their kid?
Yeah, it's a real mixed bag. There's a lot of parents that are coming to us to fact find and seek information, which is always a good thing. Obviously we're not lawyers, we're not police, we can't advise on legal matters, but we are aware of what the regulations and limitations are in our industry. And so there are some parents coming in and they're interested in getting an e-bike for their kid. They might have a 12 or 13-year-old child and they want to give them more mobility and independence. They might live a little bit further out of town but have access to a cycle path. So they want to allow them to, you know, be mobile and be independent, be able to get around on their own and not have to drive them around everywhere. And they're coming in, they're asking us about e-bikes, if there's anything available in smaller frames, smaller sizes, and we're having that conversation with them about those age limits and also the power limits and the design limits on the bikes. There are some people that genuinely are not aware that there are those limits. So there's people that are coming in asking, you know, do you have anything with a throttle that can go faster? You know, a friend of mine has one, but it's only a pedal assist and it only does 25 kilometres an hour. So we are having that conversation with people. And it's only our job just to inform them what the local regulations are and always encourage people to go and check with the local police and check what the actual restrictions are, because it can vary from state and territory.
Well, you're saying that there's a lot of them around. If they're not buying them from your shop, how else are they getting in?
Yeah, look, the main thing we're seeing is people buying them directly online. So they're buying them either as a kit conversion. That's pretty popular in our area. So it's like a wheel with a motor inside the wheel, and they kind of plug it in and attach the battery to the frame. It's pretty cool and creative what some of these people are doing. These young people, they're installing it themselves, and we're really impressed by the engineering and kind of DIY attitude. Unfortunately, 13, 14, 15-year-old kids aren't always the best at installing things safely and properly, and they might think it's okay. We kind of look at it from a, you know, from an industry perspective, and we're like, this is incredibly dangerous because you only have one really poor performing brake on your bike, or the frame is not actually engineered for the additional torque and the additional weight of the conversion. Another really popular option is people buying fully assembled bikes in a box, and they're being sold often direct to consumer through online websites. And that's not really necessarily a major competition for us. It's a different type of rider. It's a different type of market. It's the sort of person that probably wouldn't come into our store and buy one of the road legal pedal assisted e-bikes that we do sell. So it's a different type of market. It's more of this hybrid kind of bicycle electric motorbike market that people are kind of chasing after, and there does seem to be demand for that type of thing that you can, you know, pop a wheelie down the street just by pushing a throttle. And that's not something that we really sell. That's not really our market, but it's kind of a new emerging market, I'd say.
Carl, I can hear you being so diplomatic here, and I appreciate it. You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking with Carl Stade, who's the Assistant Manager of Life Cycle Bikes in the Margaret River in Western Australia, about e-bikes, especially for kids under 16s, in the wake of 2 deaths in Queensland over the past week, and a lot of concern in the community. It's something you've told me about before when we were talking about pedestrians and cycle paths only a week or two ago here on Life Matters. If it's something that you're wrestling with at the moment, the idea of giving an e-bike to the kid in your life, if it's legal, I'd love to know what's going into your thought process. My number's 0418 226 576. One says the problem's compounded by the fact that many of these kids think it's cool not to wear a helmet, so when an accident does happen, fatality increases. Another says, I don't understand why there's so much more public outcry about the danger of e-bikes than about the increasing size of SUVs, which pose a much greater risk to children. Well, I do encourage you to go back and listen to Life Matters from a week or two ago. We were talking about basically who should own the road. Should we be reducing speed limits on our roads to make them safer places for cyclists and pedestrians? And that in part is what's inspired this chat. You can send me a text 0418 226 576. Also with me is Peter Burke, General Manager of Bicycle Industries Australia and a voice in biking advocacy in Australia. Peter, welcome.
Good morning, Tegan. Thank you for having me on today.
So I'm hearing Carl say before that people are coming into the bike shop and asking about buying these bikes, but they're also just buying them direct from overseas. How did we get to this point where you can just basically import something directly?
Yeah, thanks, Tegan. Unfortunately, we've got a bit of a varied background in legislation. We used to have regulations where everything coming into the country needed to meet a minimum safety standard, and there was a mandatory importation controls on those. The federal government, in their wisdom, changed these regulations in early 2021, removing the requirement to meet any minimum standards, e-bike standard, I should say, at the point of import, and also removing the requirement for a mandatory import permit or an advisory notice. So now that's it's become voluntary, and so therefore, if you don't meet the standard, if you don't apply for the import permit, they can't reject you.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a bit of muddiness around the legalities, but there are legal limits on these bikes. What's the definition in Australia?
So this is relatively consistent across the country for what's called now defined as an EPAC, electric power assist cycle, which is the most common bike we see. It is a maximum assisted power of 250 watts, continuous rated, maximum assisted speed of 25 k's an hour. So that means if you can ride the bike faster than that, but the motor must not operate. And you can't operate just as a throttle. No pedal, no power. So they're the three major considerations when we're looking at a road legal e-bike.
What about these things that look like a motorbike but don't make any noise?
Yeah, and that's where we've got a lot of problems, because there's a very blurred line now between what is a e-bike and what has become an unroadworthy motorbike. So what we see is business models where they allow you to unlock the bike, so to speak, whether that be a code, a kit or otherwise. And so if the bike can do more than 25 k's an hour under motor, or you can just press a button, push the throttle and it takes off without pedaling, or it has a larger amount of power, it is not road legal. You won't have insurance. You're at serious risk if something goes wrong, and you're now riding an unroadworthy, unregistered motorbike effectively.
Okay, so they're not legal. They're not roadworthy. You're not insured. You're not covered. From a legal point of view, what else can we do if people are just going to ride them anyway?
Yeah, and that's something we've been grappling with. From the industry's point of view, we want to see import controls, because we want to see more people on e-bikes, because we think they're fantastic tools. They're great for transport, they're great for tourism, they're great for getting places. So we want more people on them. So we want more import controls. We also want stricter standards on what can be sold and what can be used. We also want to get rid of a loophole in the legislation that says if you promise that we're only ever going to use it on private land, you're allowed to unlock it to any speed, any power. So that if I promise I'm only ever going to use it on my farm, that means I can sell it and use it at 50, 60, 70 k's an hour. So that loophole is something that we as an industry really believe needs to be addressed and really corrected.
Is this unanimous? Like, I can see that there'd be some people who'd be like, nah, let me do what I want with my own bike on my own private property.
Well, it's one of those challenges. If this was a motorbike per se, or with a ICE or an internal combustion engine that made lots of noise, parents wouldn't let their children ride it down the footpath. So, and that's where we've got to delineate between these are still motorbikes, even though the power is an electric motor rather than an ICE or a petrol motor. Parents have now got the concept, because it's silent, because it's quiet, they think it's okay to use. We really need to say, well, no, how would you let your child use a motorbike? You wouldn't let them ride it down the footpath. Yes, we've still got agricultural bikes or dirt bikes that are used off-road, and we're happy to work with that, but we really need to clean up that legislation to make sure people understand and don't use these for use on the road.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm with Peter Burke, who's the General Manager of Bicycle Industries Australia, and Carl Stade, the Assistant Manager of Lifecycle Bikes in the Margaret River in Western Australia, talking about e-bikes, really broad term, but basically younger kids under 16, on especially high-powered bikes, and just how dangerous that can be, what right mix of legislation and restrictions are right, and what's the role of all of us in society in helping enforce them. I'd love to know if this is something that you've considered in your family, especially if you have kids. You can send me a text on 0418 226 576. A couple of parents on the text line. One says, I have a 14-year-old boy with an imported kit conversion. He loves it. He rides it with caution and fun. I recently bought a legal pedal assist bike to go on rides with him. It's much better than sitting on his PlayStation. E-bikes are unavoidable, and we need to help kids learn to do the right thing. Another from Dean, who says, I've been in the industry since 2011, converting bikes to electric. The current laws are too restrictive. Currently, the law states 250 watts and 25 kilometres per hour. This is way too slow and too low in power. Dean says almost every e-bike is illegal with throttles and higher speeds. The real problem bikes are electric motorbikes. Change the laws to 40 kilos weight and 40 kilometres per hour. More realistic. Dean says my 11-year-old has had an e-bike since he was 7. He rides a 350 watt that does 35 kilometres an hour. Safe. Well, Dean's saying that he's in this industry and he obviously disagrees with you. How do we find a consensus here on what's the right mix?
Well, Australia is a relatively immature market when it comes to e-bikes. You know, we're generally 5 years behind Europe or 10 years. We should be actually looking at the world's biggest markets and having a look at what they've done. In places like Europe, they have a 25k an hour limit, but then they also do have a 45k an hour limit, which is what Dean's probably referring to. But that product has to be registered. That person can't ride it on a footpath, can't ride it on a shared path, must be riding on the road, must undertake training, and must undertake other requirements to be allowed to use it. So we believe there's an opportunity to have higher power, higher speed bikes, but they're not e-bikes, and they shouldn't be under the same road legislation as the bicycle. And like I say, if we look around the world, there's plenty of examples where they're doing this and doing it well. We just need to, you know, 25 k's an hour, and I understand what Dean's saying, but we're talking about use on shared paths. We're talking about use on footpaths across the country. That is where we think 25 is still a reasonable limit for those types of bikes.
Another text says, it's not that difficult. Parents should be made responsible for underage riders of e-bikes that are unregulated. Then police should be targeting those riders. Parents will then be forced to take responsibility. Well, that really echoes comments made by the federal MP for Fisher on the Sunshine Coast, Andrew Wallace, who warned that parents need to step up and take responsibility for their children's safety. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
We've all seen young people tearing around on these scooters. I've had them pass me whilst I've been driving on Nicklin Way in my car, and they've literally gone past me. So parents, please, I know some parents are being really protective about this is the life of your child, because if they come off these scooters or e-bikes doing 30 or 40, 50 kilometres an hour as they're doing, particularly those kids that aren't wearing helmets, and many of them don't, there's no coming back from that. If they are lucky enough to survive in the first place, they are likely to have very, very significant brain injuries. So parents, please talk to your kids about the safe use of e-bikes and e-scooters. As a parent, you only get one chance with your child. Let's not make this, you know, have more statistics. As to the inquiry, the state government will be working through that inquiry. I look forward to seeing the results. They obviously have to go through their processes. But this is an issue that's not just about law enforcement. It's about parental involvement. Please, parents, get involved. You wouldn't know whether your child has an e-bike or an e-scooter. If they do, sit them down and have that conversation with them.
So that's Federal MP for Fisher on the Sunshine Coast, Andrew Wallace. Peter, what element of this is about policing and parenting?
It's not a single solution, as Andrew's alluded to there, the member for Fisher has alluded to. There's a couple of key elements. We need to ensure they get access to good, safe, quality product. So that is the import controls and the sales controls. But on the other hand, we need to ensure that the community and parents in most situations understand what is a road legal and safe e-bike. And so, as Andrew Wallace said there, a lot of parents are aware their child's got an e-bike, but they're not aware of that it's not actually road legal or that it goes too fast. So it is a combination of safe product and a lot of education for parents, which also flows down to the children, and working with the parents to make sure the children's or the child's behaviour is appropriate for what they're doing.
So what can we be telling parents about e-bikes? Like, what should they know? How do they educate themselves?
Well, Carl from Lifecycle and Margaret River was right on point when he said he provides a lot of good quality advice. And so that's my first point. If you're looking at an e-bike, they are bicycles. So go to a good quality bike shop, and Lifecycle in Margaret River is a good quality bike shop, and they will be able to inform you what is the local laws. Unfortunately, we haven't got consistent laws across the country, so go to a local bike shop and they will talk to you about the local laws. They will be able to talk to you about the 250 watts. They'll be able to talk to you about the 25 k's an hour. They'll be able to talk to you about throttle controls. But also, if they start talking about a product that can be unlocked, that's probably not something you want to be talking about. So bike shops will know that. And so the first point of call is a bike shop.
Peter, Carl, thank you both so much for joining me today. Peter Burke is the General Manager of Bicycle Industries Australia, and Carl Stade is the Assistant Manager of Lifecycle Bikes in the Margaret River in Western Australia. And thank you lots and lots of texts about this. Chris says, I live in Bondi Junction and think the eastern suburbs of Sydney has a real issue. I'm surprised that more kids riding bikes or pedestrians haven't been injured. I see kids milling around on paths, on the roads, across parks at high speed, some without helmets, some doing wheelies. Chris says, just last week I was walking through Bondi Junction and a kid with an unstrapped helmet was doing a mono down the footpath as the guy from the bike shop where he'd just picked it up filmed him and later uploaded it to their social media. An hour later, I was coming back the other way and a kid doing a wheelie on the path knocked over an old guy with his dog and rode off laughing. Another text says, there is an age limit to getting a driver's license for a reason. Children don't have road sense. If it has a motor of any size, they should require a license and be controlled in the same way. Another says, please don't forget the dangers to pedestrians. E-bikes regularly use Canberra's walking and bike paths, but it's very scary if you're walking on the same path. E-bike riders, take a little care of us. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, we're talking about gluten. And if you avoid it and aren't celiac, you're going to want to hear what my next guest has to say.
Ever since Beef Wellington became a murder weapon, I've been wondering, what's up with mushrooms? Hello, Anne Jones here from What the Duck, and I'm trying to work out why would fungi be so poisonous that it can kill you? And death caps in particular, why are you so, apparently, delicious? What do you want, to be eaten or not? To find out, search for What the Duck and look for mushrooms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
I can't remember exactly when it happened. It might have been sometime in the 2010s maybe, but suddenly everyone was talking about gluten. Celebrities were ditching it. Athletes were crediting their performance to cutting it out. Wellness influencers were declaring it public enemy number one for your gut. Now, if you have ever been diagnosed with celiac disease, skipping gluten isn't a trend. It is a medical must. But for everyone else who swears they're gluten sensitive or intolerant, is gluten really the villain it's made out to be? Well, a new research review published in The Lancet looking back over decades of studies says that your gluten sensitivity could actually be something else entirely. So why do so many people feel better when they cut gluten from their diet? With me is Associate Professor Jess Bersikorski, Head of the Human Nutrition Group at the University of Melbourne. Jess, welcome back to Life Matters.
Good morning, Tegan. Good to be back.
Do we know when gluten became a dietary pariah?
It was sometime in the 20s, the 2000s. Gluten's bad reputation really took off. And your intro hit the nail on the head. It was fueled by celebrity endorsements. I think you could name every celebrity that's claimed the gluten-free diet has helped them with something, whether it's Kim Kardashian, Miley Cyrus, Gwyneth Paltrow, or Novak Djokovic going from number two to number one in the world. It's been the gluten-free diet is the cure-all from fatigue, brain fog, bloating, or performance.
I don't want, like, I was sort of like, lol, wheat is the thing that kept you back from being number one instead of number two. But truly, like, if people are having those symptoms and they've cut out gluten and feeling better, like, there's not nothing going on there.
No, exactly. There's, you know, you can't argue with feeling better. And if at the end of the day they are feeling better and they're following a nutritionally adequate diet, then great. But then if you are unnecessarily cutting something out and putting unnecessary blame on something, that is when then we would like to turn to the science and work out what's going on.
Which is what you've done. You've done this review of the evidence. It's been published in The Lancet. What did you find?
Yeah, so what this Lancet piece was reviewing all of the current existing gluten-related research. This means any studies that look to see if there's a symptom response for where gluten has triggered symptoms in people that don't have celiac disease, as well as trying to understand how, so mechanistic studies. And collectively, across all of these studies, most people who believe they react to gluten show no difference when giving gluten versus a placebo. So in other words, these symptoms are real. We're not debating that. It's actually that gluten itself is not the trigger. And the evidence is showing that the culprit, instead of gluten, is often something else found in wheat, like fructans, or the way that the brain is interpreting sensations from the gut.
So a couple of potential things there. You mentioned fructans. I think that has to do with Australia has a strong role to play in the development of the FODMAP diet, which I think a lot of people have heard of, even if they're not quite sure what it is.
Yes, indeed. So if we break down what gluten is first, gluten is a protein that is found in wheat, rye, and barley. The carbohydrate component that is found in those same grains is fructans, and fructans come under the cluster or the umbrella of FODMAPs. So these are fermentable carbohydrates that we now have very good evidence, and indeed the low FODMAP diet started here in Melbourne in Australia. We have very good understanding for how FODMAPs trigger gut symptoms in people. And so when you are removing something like pasta, bread, cereal, you are removing gluten, but you're also removing fructans from your diet.
If they're in the wheat, then what does it matter if we're calling it gluten intolerance or not? Like, if you're still going to have to take that thing out of your diet, then what difference does it make?
Well, true, and there is some debate. Is it gluten intolerance or is it wheat sensitivity? But I would then argue that actually when we are removing cereals and grains unnecessarily, there is actually a difference between FODMAP restriction versus gluten-free diet. And there is more flexibility when you look at a FODMAP restrictive diet versus gluten-free. And in this group that we know nothing should, a restrictive diet should not be encouraged long term, and it should always come back to trying to reintroduce and re-establish tolerance and diversify the diet as well.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Associate Professor Jess Bersikorski about a new review of the evidence that she and her colleagues have done into whether gluten is actually the culprit when people claim to be gluten sensitive or gluten intolerant, as distinct from celiac disease. Let me be quick to point out. One person says, my husband found out he was intolerant to wheat products. From then, he called others gluten enslaved. Well, Jess, you talked about the restrictive nature of a gluten-free diet before, again, for people who don't have celiac disease, but that there are other options available. Can you just talk about what it means for someone's whole dietary quality if they're taking out a whole group like that, and what the alternatives are that aren't going to trigger these symptoms that people are feeling?
Yeah, so perhaps let's firstly talk a little bit about what it means going gluten-free. When you are following a gluten-free diet, you were possibly purchasing gluten-free alternatives, and we do know from the evidence that has done sort of market research and cost analysis that gluten-free foods are on average 139% more expensive. Those gluten-free foods are often lower in fibre, folate, and key minerals like iron and zinc. So when you are restricting a whole food group of cereals and grains and then choosing gluten-free alternatives, there are nutritional concerns. And then if you switch to something like an alternative and think about ensuring that you are still taking in enough fruits and vegetables, if under the guidance of a dietitian, you can follow a gluten-free or a gluten-restricted diet nutritionally adequately, but it really does require quite careful guidance of a dietitian.
So not just sort of cutting out something and not thinking about what you might be adding back in.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing you mentioned before when we were talking about potential role, like what's kind of at play when someone's feeling sensitive to gluten, there was the thing that, okay, maybe it's something else that you're sensitive to in the food, that's fine. The other thing you said could be at play was effectively how your brain interprets signals from your gut. I don't think people like being told that maybe a symptom is all in their head, but it is a really important part of what's going on here.
Yeah, and it's quite nuanced. And I think I want to start by saying these are real physiological responses. So the symptoms are not imagined. Rather, what we know is occurring is the brain, how the brain and the gut are communicating, or in this instance, miscommunicating. And we know the brain and the gut are closely connected, and that what we expect to happen can strongly shape how we feel. So this means we're believing that a particular food, like gluten, will cause discomfort. This will actually lead to amplifying, and our brain interpreting and amplifying any gut sensations. So the sort of psychology behind those symptoms shows that the expectation has a really powerful effect on how we feel. It doesn't mean that those symptoms are imagined. It just really comes down to this brain-gut communication and how tightly linked that brain and the gut are, and that fear and or anxiety can really amplify any real digestive discomfort and sensations occurring.
So I'm feeling weird when I eat bread. I know that I'm not celiac. What do I do?
And as long as you have indeed ruled out celiac disease, and for anybody who's listening that might feel like gluten or wheat products are an issue for them, strongly encourage, please go see your GP. Ensure that you do have adequate celiac disease testing that is only accurate when you still have gluten in your diet. So you cannot go and get an accurate test for celiac disease if you have already started restricting gluten from your diet. Once celiac disease and wheat allergy have been ruled out, we encourage people to focus on overall diet quality. If your gut symptoms are persisting, please seek out a dietitian. They can talk to you about following a structured low FODMAP diet and in a way that will keep those restrictions really targeted and temporary. If there is still a potential role for gluten that needs to be investigated, that dietitian can help guide a really short-term and targeted gluten-free trial and then re-challenge to confirm exactly what the culprit is. And it's really important that those restrictions are short-term to avoid unnecessary long-term food avoidance.
Dietitians are magicians. I've got a couple of questions here on the text line that I might put to you, Jess, about yeast. One person says, I seem to tolerate toasted bread, whereas fresh bread bloats me. I make my own bread with minimal yeast. Another says, I had allergies my whole life and have been tested for celiac. I found I was getting bloating, tiredness, and bad eczema. I eliminated yeast and it helped me immediately. I can still eat wheat, but not yeast. Can yeast be the culprit?
It's interesting because the yeast is getting an increasing attention in these dietary trials. We don't have a lot of these placebo-controlled, double-blind challenge yeast studies to confirm yay or nay if that is a specific effect or not. I also wonder, when you are making your own bread, what other flours are you using? What other processing methods are you using? Are you using something like a sourdough approach? We do know sourdough can reduce the fructan level. So you may actually be choosing a lower FODMAP bread, and therefore it might actually come back to those fermentable carbohydrates as well, playing a role.
Jess, thanks for sharing your knowledge with us again today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tegan.
Associate Professor Jess Bersikorski is head of the Human Nutrition Group at the University of Melbourne. Well, coming up next, we're kind of sticking with gluten in that I'm talking with a croissant founder, Loon Croissanterie founder, Kate Reid, about the book that changed her life, or actually a photo in a cookbook. That's next.
A standout feature of the ABC Listen app, free audiobooks. Now available, Tim Winton's unsettling and suspenseful The Writers.
All the time she waited for him to give up, praying for him to give up.
Gloomy and terrifying, Stephanie Meyer's Twilight.
Thick fog was all I could see out my window in the morning.
And Casey Chambers' Just Don't Be a Dickhead and Other Profound Things I've Learned. For lovers of great stories, find these and other free audiobooks on the ABC Listen app.
Well, ABC Radio National's Top 100 Books Countdown a couple of weeks ago, nothing short of a raging success. You can actually still go back and listen to the broadcast if you'd like to relive some of those moments. But as part of that competition, I was inspired to talk to some notable readers about the book that they say changed their life. And even though the countdown is over, I don't want to stop asking these questions because you get such great answers. Today, Kate Reid, author and founder of the very famous Lune Croissanterie, explains how a book inspired her to abandon a life as an F1 engineer and conquer Australia's baking scene.
My name is Kate Reid. I'm the founder and co-owner of Lune Croissanterie, and the book that changed my life is Paris Patisseries: History, Shops and Recipes, with the foreword by Pierre Hermé. I first read this book when I was very ill. I'd returned to Australia from the UK after a stint of working in Formula One with a new passion that I wanted to pursue, which was pastry. I was working in a small cafe in Melbourne making quite simple cakes, tarts and biscuits, but I'd started to develop an appetite for more complicated recipes and I'd turned my eye towards French pastry. So I borrowed this book from the Camberwell Library with a view to learning a little bit more about the French cuisine. I opened randomly to this double page photo of chocolatine, or as we know them in Australia, more commonly pain au chocolat. And it was so hypnotizing, the image. You could see every perfect layer of pastry. It was almost like you could smell the butter coming out of the page. And I literally closed the book, walked back up to Camberwell and bought myself a ticket to Paris. I actually went to the boulangerie when I was in Paris, and the experience of visiting that store was just so life-altering that I asked if I could get an apprenticeship at the bakery, and the owner and head chef of the bakery was so kind. He actually allowed me to return to Paris and complete a stage, which is where I discovered the incredible croissant and completely fell in love with pastry. For me, the croissant is the Formula One of the pastry world. It's so complex and difficult to make, and it requires intricate technique and perfecting. So it really led me down the path of what I wanted to pursue and specialise in my baking career. Before I discovered baking, my first career was an aerodynamicist in Formula One, working for the Williams F1 team in the UK. So incredibly different to baking. When I saw the photo, the aerodynamicist in me saw aerofoil sections with particles tracing the flow visualization around, for example, the cross-section of a wing. I was doing a deep dive interview with Julie Gibbs, who's currently documenting, the culinary history of Australia. And I told her about my experience of finding this book and going to Paris. And earlier this year, I met with her for a drink and she gave me a wrapped gift. And I unwrapped it and she has found me an original copy of it. The one that's sitting in front of me is beaten up, the cover's torn, it has been well loved, but it is incredibly special to own a copy of it now. And I opened the book and looked at the photo and I was literally transported back to 2009, sitting on my floor of the lounge room in my parents' house and just feeling this need and this draw to Paris. So yeah, it's now something that I revisit thanks to Julie. We don't know who the author of this book is, but when I was writing my memoir, Destination Moon, I was sitting in this tiny little village in Tuscany and Julie hadn't given me the copy of the book yet. So I was trying to remember if that photo was as impactful as I'd imagined it was. And so I did some research and I found out who the photographer of the book was, and it was a really old Frenchman who now lives somewhere in Provence. And he just happened to have an Instagram account. So I sent him a message on Instagram without hope that I'd hear back, asking if he still had a copy of that photo and if he could possibly send it to me. And I never did hear back until about a week ago. And this is maybe 18 months from when I messaged him. And he'd just seen my message and he does still have a copy of the original photo and he asked if I would like a copy of it. I think that needs to be framed and hanging in my house. I'm Kate Reid and that was the book that changed my life.
Paris Patisseries: History, Shops, Recipes. As Kate said, we don't know who the author is, but the foreword is by Pierre Hermé. Thank you, Kate Reid, so much for sharing. Well, up next here on Life Matters, how our photos shape our memories of holidays. Do you have a favourite holiday photo? Maybe it's got blue skies, it might be on a beach, Or perhaps it's one where your family's posed against a snowy mountain backdrop looking like you're in a catalogue for jumpers or something like that. And I bet if it is your favourite, the photo brings back happy memories. But if you think a little deeper, is there also a memory surfacing of the big fight you were having just before the shutter clicked or the airline that lost your luggage? Why do perfect holiday photos feel like we had a perfect holiday when we all know a perfect holiday doesn't actually exist? Well, our resident consumer expert, Paul Harrison, is with me. He joins me fortnightly for Buyer Beware. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks, Tegan.
Do you have a picture-perfect holiday in mind as I'm speaking about this?
It's so funny because I was thinking, what is one of my favourite photographs from a holiday? And it's not picture-perfect, but when we visited relatives in Myrtle Beach in the United States, and my daughter had gone crazy on the cereal and she took little packets. And then when we got to the airport, they actually were saying, "Why have you got all this stuff?" And I have a photo of her sitting in the search area with a very sad look on her face. In the end, it was because I think she had water in her bag. But that photo brings back so many happy, fond memories. And it's not pretty and it's not blockbuster, but it feeds into the story that I tell myself about the holiday. And I think that's the reason that I take photos, because I want to all of the detail, the ordinary stuff as well as the blockbuster stuff.
That's so interesting, because am I right in thinking there is research into this, so basically saying that if we have pretty photos, we remember enjoying our holiday maybe more than we did? I don't know how they test that.
Yeah, it does.
Are they asking people on holidays how sad they are?
What they're doing is, well, there's a couple of different kind of studies that have looked at it. One of them is that they give people an opportunity to just go around and take photos of anything they like. And so in a way, it's kind of like you're asking people to kind of just, you know, take photos whenever you feel take a photo. But a different study, they actually said, people say, I want you to take a photograph of something when you're at a high level of experience or something like that. And others were, I want you to take photographs for your social media feed. One of the things that they found in one of these studies is that when people took the photo, just for personal reasons, they remembered more of the experience and they enjoyed more from those photos, and they actually had a sense of well-being that came out of that. But when they were photographing it for someone else, in inverted commas, so for an unknown audience on your kind of social media feed, people actually experienced it, had a less than pleasant experience. They remembered less of the experience because what they were doing was they were monitoring. It's called self-presentational monitoring. They were actually anticipating the audience, and therefore they were kind of experiencing the moment, but also half considering how it would look online, and that takes away the experience.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Paul Harrison, our resident consumer expert who joins me fortnightly. We call our segment Buyer Beware. So Paul, what I was hearing you say before was really like there's the photo taking effect, which is one thing that can be nice, and then there's the social media effect, which can make things, you feel more observed.
Yeah, and you're not taking it, you're taking it for an unknown audience. And so what we're doing is that we're not living in the moment. And I know that there's a lot of romanticism about this idea of don't take photos, live in the moment. And I think that the key here is to go, why am I taking the photograph? And so if the photograph is for some form of external validation, this idea of saying I'm creating this for an audience, it reduces your enjoyment and it actually weakens the recall. And so it's more about taking the photo for yourself, stopping and processing it and saying, what does this look like? And one of the things I find really interesting is that now that we have cameras on our phones, we just have an unlimited amount of capacity to take photographs. And so we're never really engaging with the photograph. If you think about in the past, I'm not saying that it was better in the past, but if we had 36 photographs on a film, we'd have to actually think, do I want to take this photo? And what you'd also get is you'd get people and things that weren't necessarily perfectly posed. And that then creates a much deeper, thoughtful memory. It creates a story. And the story that you were just talking about, the Milford track, but also Kate Reid's story as well about these photographs, it creates memories. And I think that's the thing that's missing when we have our camera with us all of the time or on our phone all of the time. We're just snapping away at every old thing.
So do you think we should be leaving our phones in the hotel room or taking photos but not posting them to Instagram? Like, what do we do with this information?
Yes, what do you do with this information? I think one of the things to do is to take photographs with intention. And what I mean by that is to say, well, you know, why am I taking this photograph? I think reducing the amount of photographs that we take is a good idea. I think one of the things to do, and my daughter does this, is that when she travels, she takes photographs, but she doesn't post anything on her social media feed until she returns, because her time to kind of think, what do I want to show, rather than necessarily, I guess, curating every day and just sending it out. And that's fine, because people like to kind of, you know, travel vicariously with you. I think one of the things is it is very much about moderation and intention. So you ask yourself, who am I taking this for? Why am I taking it? Don't try to make it perfect, because often the best photographs are the ones that are imperfect. People, you know, blinking or a bright flash or something like that, because what it does is it gives you a memory and it reminds us that, as you were saying, ordinary things in the holiday are just as much a part of the holiday. So waiting lines, exhaustion, somebody travelling with you who's looking back at you really annoyed because you're always taking photographs. It's about being intentional about why you photograph and what you're photographing.
Has looking into this research changed the way you interact with your camera on holidays?
Kind of. It's a hard thing to undo, I think. I do take a lot of photographs, but it forces me a little bit more to go, why am I taking this photograph? And it's practice. I think, I mean, I do this research for a living, but I'm still a consumer and I'm still part of the world. So sometimes I just have to remind myself, but I'm always cautious about saying live in the moment, because one of the things I know, and, you know, this is something that I used to do with my wife, you know, when our kids were little, is that we would go 6 to 12 months later and we'd go and grab the photo albums and we'd go, do you want to take a walk down memory lane? And we just look at the photographs kind of thing. And we'd look through and we'd remember those moments. And I think that's how we should photograph. We should photograph as a form of memory creation, as one of the many memory creations. So journaling, having conversations, debriefing, talking to people when you get back, photographs, all of that feed into, I guess, the joy of the experience of the holiday, as well as the ordinary stuff.
I'm feeling like this is like bringing back the slideshow that you used to do.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. No, just you and the person you travelled with, I think. Yeah, don't invite the neighbours over. That's scary.
Fair enough. Well, you were mentioning the idea of taking photos, maybe posting the less glamorous parts of travelling. Sometimes when I see people doing that on social media, it feels performative in its own way.
Yeah, it can be. And I think, again, it's more about what suits you. And I mean, one of the things is that I like to kind of, you know, build an element around that, which is, you know, this is part of my personality as well. I like to see the ordinary. So it's more about reflecting what you are. But I think, again, just posting everything that's beautiful and filters and things like that is also just as performative. So it's trying to find that balance between those things. And I think if we go back to how I travel, I do the blockbuster photos just like everybody else. But I also then go, this is a really interesting kind of way to look at this beautiful place. And it may well be something that is not as pretty as normal. But again, I think it still kind of leads to people going, okay, or to you going, you know, what does this mean? I think it still comes back, though, to social media and the intention. So if you're just posting it for social media, then that's a different intention to posting it for yourself. And I think what the research tells us is that when we are photographing for ourselves, we have stronger kind of memory recall, we have better well-being, we enjoy that experience more. So I think, again, if there was, you know, one thing to take away, it's to photograph for yourself and then think about what you're going to do with the photograph later. It's hard to do, but I think that's the best way to approach it.
So, Paul, you're off to New Zealand in a week. Will you be taking
a
camera?
Of course I will. Of course I will, because I want those memories. And I've already kind of thought, what kind of photos do I want to take? And, yeah, exactly. I think I'll take my phone, but I'll also take a little kind of camera that, you know, is a pull it out and everything. And take photos. But I think the thing I'm thinking is, yes, I do want to take photographs, but partly because last night, even before I was even thinking about preparing for today, I actually, every night I look at photographs. And I think that's one way to kind of remind me of, I guess, the privilege that I have to be able to travel, but also the beautiful people that I travel with, the people that I meet, the places that I go to. It's about actually not just taking the photographs for the sake of it, but actually saying this is part of memory reconstruction and kind of building a life.
Dr. Paul Harrison, thank you as always for chatting with me. Paul is Head of Consumer Behaviour at Deakin. He joins me fortnightly to unpack why we spend and behave the way we do. We call our chats Buyer Beware. And I'm loving your texts on your favourite holiday snaps. Sue says, I let my autistic grandson use my phone to take photos at the zoo. It kept him calm and enjoying the experience. His photos bring joy to me from that time. Definitely a different perspective. And Amanda says, my favourite holiday snap is a black and white picture of my three kids aged 12, 10 and 8 in a beautiful park in Mudgee. Moments before they were arguing furiously, yet somehow they were all smiling in this image. Now it's very hard to get a picture of them at ages 18, 17 and 14 as they refuse to be in any image that I take. Well, earlier in the show, we talked about power-assisted bikes, e-bikes, and how tricky they are to navigate, especially with children. Even though the laws vary from state to state, they're not really meant to be used by kids. They're not meant to be unlocked above a certain speed and power, and yet we still see terrible incidents, including two deaths in the last week in Queensland. Well, earlier I spoke to Peter Burke, who's the General Manager of Bicycle Industries Australia, and he had some really valuable advice to parents whose kids are asking for an e-bike.
It's not a single solution, as Andrew's alluded to there, the member Fisher has alluded to. There's a couple of key elements. We need to ensure they get access to good, safe, quality product. So that is the import controls and the sales controls. But on the other hand, we need to ensure that the community and parents in most situations understand what is a road legal and safe e-bike. And so as Andrew Wallace said there, a lot of parents are aware their child's got an e-bike, but they're not aware of that it's not actually road legal or that it goes too fast. So it is a combination of safe product and a lot of education for parents, which also flows down to the children, and working with the parents to make sure the children's or the child's behaviour is appropriate for what they're doing.
What can we be telling parents about e-bikes? Like, what should they know? How do they educate themselves?
If you're looking at an e-bike, they are bicycles. So go to a good quality bike shop and they will be able to inform you what is the local laws. Unfortunately, we haven't got consistent laws across the country. So go to a local bike shop and they will talk to you about the local laws. They will be able to talk to you about the 250 watts. They'll be able to talk to you about the 25 k's an hour. They'll be able to talk to you about throttle controls. But also, if they start talking about a product that can be unlocked, that's probably not something you want to be talking about. So bike shops will know that. The first point of call is a bike shop.
That's Peter Burke, the General Manager of Bicycle Industries Australia, with some valuable advice there. The full conversation that we had will be online shortly after today's program. You'll be able to find it on the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts, and on the web. Thank you as well for your texts. So many people texting me. We've stopped walking on the shared walking/bike paths because of children flying along the paths on e-bikes, often with pillions, barely missing us. Another text says, I'm concerned that kids are riding around me doing 60 k's an hour. Some of these bikes cost $3,500. I think it's a case of the haves and have-nots. Parents feel pressure to buy one while we are apparently in a cost of living crisis. Sally says, wouldn't it be better to have national laws and regulations, especially considering the danger? What about a test for new riders similar to a driver's license? And Sandy says, none of the food delivery drivers pedal. They all have throttles and there's no policing of it. It gives the regular non-powered bike rider a bad name. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters coming to you today. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about updated figures on what it costs to raise a child these days, which has got me wondering, what's the best money you have ever spent on your kids? I'll be taking your calls after 9 a.m. tomorrow, but you don't have to wait until 9 to get in touch with me. If you want to reach out, my email address is lifematters@abc.net.au. And I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.